From longtime New York Times columnist Frank Bruni comes the new book, The Age of Grievance, which is an examination of the ways in which grievance has come to define our current culture and politics on both the right and the left. Grievance needn't be bad. It has done enormous good. The U.S. is a nation born of grievance, and across the nearly 250 years of our existence as a country, grievance has been the engine of morally urgent change. But what happens when all sorts of grievances, the greater ones, the lesser ones, the authentic, the invented, are all jumbled together? When people take their grievances to lengths that they didn't before? Those are the questions addressed in The Age of Grievance, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Frank Bruni to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So nice to have you on the program. Frank Bruni has been a journalist for more than three decades, including more than 25 years at the New York Times, and roles as diverse as op-ed columnist, White House correspondent, Rome bureau chief, and chief restaurant critic. He joins us in his role as an author of The Age of Grievance. The picture on the book has a match lit, and then there is gas being poured on that match, gas can at the top of the book. I mean, that pretty much says it, doesn't it?
That is a pretty, I think, apt metaphor for the way our politicians behave and the way our public discussions tend to go.
Now, I assume you were brought up similar to the way I was brought up, which was don't pour gas in a fire. So what happened to us, do you believe, where that became, let's see what happens when we pour gas on a fire?
I mean, a lot of things have happened. One of the obvious ones, and I think we sometimes almost don't give it enough credit because it's such an obvious answer, is social media. But social media is also part of, obviously, the internet and a whole information age in which we have many more places to go for our information. There's a kind of competition for attention that was never quite this intense before. And people have seen that shouting gets attention, that anger is catalyzing and animating. And so, yeah, pouring gas on a fire is the way in the sort of cacophonous bedlam of today's media environment, today's social media environment, that you actually are heard and seen.
Where does it get us, though? Because, the ultimate is that there is going to be an explosion. And is that ever a good thing?
An explosion? No. Well, I mean, I guess you can say that if something is entirely rotten and broken, maybe you start over. I, for one, don't think America is entirely rotten or broken, and it distresses me to witness, observe how many people do. Where it's gotten us, that's probably the thing I'm most interested in exploring in the book, or that I explore at greatest length, what all of this is costing us. It's costing us the ability to have constructive political engagement and make progress on issues and problems where we really need to make progress. It's caused a sort of nastiness in American life. You know, I remember two decades ago, we talked only of road rage.
Right.
Now you have air rage, you have restaurant rage, you have retail shop rage. We've become extraordinarily confrontational and mean-spirited in a way that feels different to me from any other point of my adult life.
In reading the book, I came across something that I just had this feeling that something my wife and I talk about a lot, which is what you just mentioned, but also that we feel entitled, that there's an entitlement that didn't seem to be there before.
Yeah, something about our political discourse tells various people, here's what you're owed, here's what you're not getting, here's how shortchanged you should feel, here's how angry you should be, here's how much gas you should be pouring on the flame. And what gets lost in that is any sense of a collective good. And we can't lose sense of the collective good. We are a nation, we are a democracy, we're all in this together. No one of us gets to have our country or our world exactly to our liking. And that used to be something that we could maturely recognize and accept. But I feel like we're living in an age of mass immaturity. I feel like there's been an infantilization of a lot of people's political engagement, an infantilization in the way that they conduct their discourse. And I think we need to move beyond it. I mean, That's the other thing. We don't need to be trapped here. And one thing I hope the book does justice to is the idea that if we would make various alterations in the way we elect politicians, in the way we use social media, in the way we sort ourselves geographically, we can move beyond this and we can have a much, much healthier country than we do right now.
Give us a sense of some of those alterations that you think could set us in a better direction.
On the political front, we need to make a much bigger effort than we have to get rid of gerrymandering. And in fact, Michigan has done that. There was a terrific story in the New York Times about 3 weeks ago, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, about all the ways in which Michigan had gone from being less democratic to more democratic. And they were basically talking about the kinds of political reforms that, if we saw them happen nationally, would tone down our politics, would lessen the number of extremists, would make each state feel more representative, and I think would make Americans thus feel more invested in the system. I think we can put money into regions and cities in a way that we encourage people of diverse backgrounds, of diverse socioeconomic classes to cross paths so that we push back against the socioeconomic geographic sorting of American life right now. I think we should really look harder than we have at a national service program. Again, because it would build a collective spirit and bring diverse people together. I mean, those are just some. I could go on and on, but there are remedies available to us if we just recognize how dysfunctional we've become and if we find the will to move beyond that.
You did mention social media as far as one of the concerns. What are some of the fixes there, do you think?
Well, one of the fixes is a sort of amorphous one, but I think maybe the most important of all, which is to have conversations with young people as they begin to use social media about how they're setting up their information feeds, about how they're deciding whom to follow, whom to repost, whom to share. Because I know in my role now, I've been a professor at Duke University for the last 3 years, that most young people end up with a social media life and a social media ecosystem that just sort of happens to them and often isn't in remote alignment with what they mean to be happening and whom they want to be. But nobody has ever said, hey, let's pause, take a look, let's make some adjustments, let's bring your social media, let's bring your information ecosystem, your news diet into line with what you really want to know and whom you really want to be. I think we need to do that. I think we need to look at some regulation that doesn't exist. We don't treat social media platforms the way we do publishers. We don't hold them responsible for disseminating lies the way we do publications with defamation law. We need to reinvestigate that.
The name of Frank Bruni's new book is The Age of Grievance. It is published by Avid Reader Press. The idea of a grievance and of the the airing of the grievances is this idea that we're not being heard. And if everybody feels they're not being heard, then that's where the problem lies, right?
It is a big part of the problem. And the truth of the matter is, if you are one side of the political divide, you often aren't being heard by people on the other side and vice versa, because we've become so partisan. And we've not just become partisan, but a phrase that was used relatively infrequently a decade ago and now is the defining feature of our political life is negative partisanship. You have politicians basically saying to the people whom they want to vote for them, vote for me, because I am the best enemy of the other side. Vote for
Right.
me to keep those other people from getting power and oppressing you. And that sort of negative energy and negative dynamic is terrible for civic life.
The word grievance appears in the First Amendment, and in that context, it is a righteous thing. But we don't use it. We use it as a synonym for being pissed off.
And that's a symptom of the problem. You're exactly right. Grievance used to be a neutral or even a noble word. But now, I mean, you could do this. We could, after you listen to this, you could go online, you could Google the word grievance, look for its appearances in the last 24 hours or the last week, and you would find it's almost always used in a pejorative context. It almost always has negative connotations. And that's a real tell. It has those negative connotations because people are lodging so many complaints at such volume and with such velocity that it all feels overwrought, hyperbolic, illegitimate. And so grievance has come to mean this sort of petty, overblown complaint, when really grievance used to be something else. And what we need to do to get on a better path is to draw distinctions between what is an urgent righteous cause and what is a petty, self-indulgent, narcissistic grievance.
So one of the things that I and you touch on this, or you write about this in the book, and I really clung to it, which is the idea that as Trump has come on the scene and during 2015 and through that election and 2016 and obviously through his administration, the thing that I was surprised about, I don't know, a surprise may not be the word, but to realize just how angry people are, the anger that he was able to tap into. And I'm interested in your thoughts of how long that anger has been festering.
I think it's been festering for a long time, and I think there are always currents and strains of anger in American political life, and it increases, you know, it waxes, it wanes. I think this anger really got fed and began to spike in a whole new way right around 2008, 2009. I think the financial collapse, or the near collapse of the global economy and the collapse of the housing market at that time, wiped out a lot of people's savings, you know, put them in horrible economic circumstances for a number of years. At the same time, you had the forces of globalization decimating factory towns and leaving Americans who did not have college educations or work in white collar, so to speak, professions, made them feel very left behind and hopeless. You also had the election in 2008 of Barack Obama, and that to many Americans, it shouldn't have been, but it was a kind of disturbing suggestion that the very complexion of their country was changing. That unsettled some people. You put all of that together, and I think a lot of people just feel like they're living in an era and in a country they don't quite recognize, and one that doesn't offer them hope of a better tomorrow. And a key thing here that we haven't mentioned, and it's so key, it's as key as social media, is this country's turn from a fundamental optimism to a whole new American pessimism. It is astonishing when you look at survey data, how much the numbers have gone down when you ask parents, do you expect your children to have a better life than you had? Saying yes to that used to be such a fundamental part of the American character. Social mobility, advancement, climbing the economic ladder, tomorrow being brighter than yesterday, and the economy always growing. These were articles of faith in this country. Maybe there was something naive about it, but that's all changed in a very, very significant way. And if you no longer believe the economy is going to grow and grow, if you no longer believe that everyone could have a better tomorrow, you begin to see somebody else's win as your loss, somebody else's advancement as your regression, and you become competitive with your fellow citizens in a way that is different, consequential, and destructive.
I mean, just in what you're talking about, the whole idea of make America great again. We're not looking, it doesn't seem that anything that is coming from that side of the aisle is really looking at how to make us great again, but to complain about what has gone wrong and what continues to go wrong.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Make America great again means something very different than each word literally. Make America great again is really a wish to go back to the past. And it's a fundamentally negative sentiment because it's saying we're not remotely great now. And here's one of the ironies of the whole situation. We are great. I mean, it's a simple reductive word,
sure.
But President Obama in his second term, when I think he was getting more philosophical, he was speaking in different ways because he wasn't just angling for re-election. He couldn't run for re-election. He gave a very famous is too big a word, but he gave a very noticed speech in Hanover, Germany, I think about 2 years before his presidency ended. And he said something very true that we often forget, which is if you were given the opportunity to be alive at any moment in history and in any place, you would choose to be alive in America today. For all of our problems, for all of our complaints, for all of our grievances, we are living in an era of prosperity, of relative peace, right? We haven't had a draft in a very long time, of relative abundance. And it is a problem that we can't occasionally pull back from our disappointments, take a wide angle lens view, and realize that despite all the things we need to make better, despite all the injustices we still need to address, we are a blessed people in a blessed time.
As you were starting to answer about one of the fundamental problems and talking about pessimism, which was fascinating. Where I thought you were going to go is about your business, my business, the media, the coverage of news and news organizations. And you write about this, of how ultimately we should rethink how we should approach and take a second look at how we're doing this job.
1,000%. Absolutely. We focus so relentlessly, so mercilessly on all the things that are going wrong, you know, a world on fire, on and on. And while that is a big part of our job, it's not the only part of our job. There are studies showing how many Americans have simply turned the news off because it's just too depressing. Those who haven't turned it off do things like doom scrolling. Right. That's a neologism, doom scrolling, that says so much about who we are and what the media is feeding us. People need to have hope to work on important problems. They need to believe there are solutions. And I think too often you and I and other people in this business do not give people any hope and solutions. We just pile on the despair and pile on more of the despair. And I think we need to take a look at that and make some changes.
Do you think that'll change the relationship that people have with the news media?
It might, but I mean, they have a lot of responsibility here. One thing that I think a lot of consumers don't realize is if they want a different kind of news and a different kind of news environment, they have more power to create that than ever, because we know what they're doing in a way we never did before. I work at the New York Times. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, if you wanted to know what your readers were responding to, you had to do things like convene focus groups, which are really blunt, inaccurate tools. Now, we know exactly who's reading what stories. I don't mean in a nanny cam individual way, but we know which stories are getting the most clicks. We know which stories readers are spending the most time with. We know which stories they're sharing the most. And so when people asked us after 2017, why did you publish so much about Trump? I always said in public when I got asked that question, why did you click on everything about Trump? Because if you had started clicking in much greater numbers on John Kasich, you would have gotten more John Kasich, because we see that and we respond to it. So I would issue this kind of gentle plea to Americans: if you want a better news environment, know that every keystroke of yours, every decision you make is registered somewhere and influences the news you're going to get a week from now and a month from now.
And it go. I mean, that. But a lot of it's innate, right? I mean, we've been doing this for centuries of looking at the train wreck or the car crash or the rubbernecking.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is human nature, but it's not all of human nature, and it's mm-hmm. not. And we don't need to feed that part of human nature quite as gluttonously as we do.
Frank Bruni has been a longtime New York Times columnist. His new book is The Age of Grievance. I will say that the way you end this book, I think, is beautiful, because the title of the chapter is The Antidote, and it's something so easy and simple and yet probably so difficult to obtain, and that is humility. And I'd like you to address that as the antidote, but also just what happened to humility of, and again, this is right and left, of... In a political speech, this is what I did. This is what I did for you. This is what I'm going to do for you. No one else can do this. I can do this. And that is, well, that's not humble, is it?
No, it's funny. I thought you were going to use a different phrase, which I think sums up the crisis of humility in our country right now. I alone can fix it.
Yes,
I alone can fix it. Yep. That is what Donald Trump said in 2016, accepting the Republican presidential nomination. And then he went on to give an inaugural speech that, unlike the first inaugural speech of Barack Obama, unlike the first inaugural speech of George W. Bush, did not have the word humbled anywhere in it, right? I don't know how we got here, but if each of us doesn't realize that other people have as much right to the public square as we do, that we are not always right, that our interests don't matter more than everybody else's, we're just never going to move to a better place. When I look at January 6th, I not only see a group of people who are frenzied, who were savage, who were violent, I see a group of people who were unhumble, because they decided that if the election didn't turn out the way they wanted, that was not okay. Or that it couldn't possibly be the case that a majority of Americans felt differently than they did. They were above all unhumble, and it was the sort of funhouse mirror version of being unhumble, but there's a little bit of that in all of us right now, and we need to work on it.
So let me end with this question, which is how do we do both things at once, in the sense of be humble, to feel humility, but also have in our quiver the ability to share a grievance when we have one?
I think we need to make sure that what we're sharing, and again, grievance is a tough word now because it has negative connotations. I think we need to make clear that when we are lobbying for something, arguing for something, pointing out an injustice in the world that affects us, we do it with a language that's persuasive and reasonable. We do it at a volume that's constructive, and we ask ourselves before we do it whether we're asking for something that must be addressed or whether we're having a snip.
I assume, being a columnist for as long as you've been a columnist, I mean, you've seen this in real time in the response to your work, of how people respond and what they say to you about what you write.
Yeah, no, I get a lot of response. The most interesting thing about that, though, I'll tell you, is this, and it has to do with the problem of all of us seeing each other as abstractions and caricatures. When I get a nasty email, and I get tons of them, if I respond to it in a measured, reasonable way, almost every time the person writes back and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to come across like that. I
Yeah.
really don't hate you that much," because I've suddenly become a flesh and blood person and not a political caricature and not an abstraction.
Right.
So we need to find ways in American life to connect each of us to one another so that we see each other as complicated, fully dimensional human beings and not as abstractions and caricature.
That's so funny you say that, because that happens here all the time, where you just get this blanket letter, and then when you write them back, they spend the rest, 3 days apologizing. But what do we do to make that more of a case in our presentation, that okay, I am Frank Bruni, I am Joe Donahue, and this is what we're doing?
Well, I mean, if you mean how do we launch our how do we have our political kind of causes and all that, I think back to the success of the marriage equality movement, right, which was very meaningful to me, and I spent a lot of time writing about it. That movement was so successful in the end because the leading voices didn't say to people standing in their way, "You are terrible, you are evil, I can't believe how much you're oppressing me." They said, "We really respect this institution of yours. We have many values that overlap with yours, and we want to join, we want in." I think that's a model for meaningful, constructive discourse.
Frank Bruni is a New York Times columnist, a best-selling author, and the author of the new book, The Age of Grievance, which is published by Avid Reader Press. Frank, what a great pleasure to share with you this morning. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's my honor. Thank you.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Age of Grievance by Frank Bruni. It's published by Avid Reader Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.